Well, nothing like a bit of Jake Cocker on a wet Auckland day to get the heart racing. I'm Sheldon Brown, host of Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and we've got technician Declan Curran with us. And Mental Health Radio is funded and brought to you by Framework. So today we review a much-heralded submission to the government inquiry into mental health and addiction called the Wellbeing Manifesto. It talks about the mental health transition from big psychiatry in New Zealand to big community and advocates a focus on well-being rather than mental distress or mental illness. So here to explain the manifesto is Mary O'Hagan, the principal architect of the work and well-known as a former mental health commissioner, lived experience advocate and currently director of Peerzone. So welcome, Mary, back to Take It From Us. It's been a while between interviews.
Cheers, Sheldon. It's nice to be with you again.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's great to have you back on the show. And, this wellbeing manifesto has grabbed a fair amount of attention in mental health circles. How would you broadly describe the document?
Well, I think the transition from big psychiatry to big community sums up the sort of the key message that runs through it. And so at the moment, we have a system where you could say that psychiatry sits at the hub of that system. Now, we do have, in New Zealand, we're lucky enough to have, you know, about a quarter of our funding going into community support services. But, you know, they're still funded through the DHB. And so what happens in our system is that psychiatry and all those allied medical type professions, they kind of they sort of dominate the world view, if you like, and they take up most of the available resources. Now, the problem with that is, so that would be great if it worked for people, but the problem is that if you talk to anyone who, you know, has you know, major mental distress, they'll say, look, I needed help with housing, self-management, employment, income. I needed talking therapies, or I needed help with my physical health care and with getting connected to my community, or I needed to get connected back to my culture. And big psychiatry isn't set up to help very well with all those things. So
help at all, Mary.
No. Well, I'm trying to be tactful about it, Sheldon. No,
right.
They're not set up to do that. They're trained to, you know, diagnose and prescribe and treat people with what they call mental illness. And while that has a place for some people, there's all these other responses that people need that cannot be provided in the way our system is set up. And so the key structural recommendation in the Wellbeing Manifesto in response to this situation and this need is that we need multi-sector community-led funding, probably at the local level, rather than, you know, all the funding or most of it being channeled through the DHB and going through that filter and going through that particular worldview. And in our current system, the DHB is also the provider of services, so they make sure that they're well looked after.
Yeah, but Mary, sorry, if I could just
NGOs,
before we get on to sort of the guts of your wellbeing manifesto, I think it's probably important for our listeners to understand a distinction between big psychiatry and big community, because these
I can sort of go through that with you. So, when we talk about big psychiatry, we're talking about you know, people in this world of big psychiatry, mental disorder is viewed primarily as a health problem, okay? Now, In a big community system, mental distress is viewed as a recoverable social, psychological, spiritual or health disruption. So there's a much more holistic view about that experience.
In the current community mental health services that are offered, so you're reasonably positive and optimistic about what's happening in what you term to be big community.
Well, I think we've started to make the transition to big community when we closed down the big mental hospitals and started to fund, you know, community support services. What we're arguing in the wellbeing manifesto is that that's only one step of many that need to be taken. Now, the community mental health services, you know, the kind of the support services, the NGO, that are run by the NGOs effectively, some of them do a great job, and I think some of them don't do such a great job. I think there's still an issue with people getting stuck for life in some of these services, and perhaps there needs to be a reorientation to doing something more purposeful than check in and chat, but actually, doing what it takes to broaden people's horizons and show them a life beyond being what's termed a mental health consumer.
But the point, though, Mary, there is that these clients are the bread and butter of funding, aren't they? They're the basis of justifying funding to those community mental health services. So if you achieve recovery with people and get them out of the service, then you lose a proportion of your funding.
Well, that's been a perverse incentive that we have seen in our system at times, particularly with supported accommodation. And I think any savvy funder has to deal with those things. Mm. I mean, you could just as easily reward people who provide services with incentives when, you know, someone in their service, is no longer needs it or gets a job or whatever. There could be a number of things that... these things are tricky, though. Mm. There's always... these incentives and these things can... They always have the little hooks in them that have unintended consequences.
Right. You have a very great synopsis in the front of this wellbeing manifesto, which really covers the history of mental health in New Zealand. And you say here that New Zealand led the world in making a transition from big psychiatry. I suppose that was the closure of the big bins and moving to big community. What were the things that we did well in that transition, do you think?
Well, I think if you compare us to any other Western country, our closure of the big institutions was far more total than anywhere else. Unfortunately, there's been a bit of a burgeoning of sort of long-term beds. I mean, I understand that, someone can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've been told that, for instance, up at the old Porirua Hospital site, which is now called Kenepuru, there are more beds up there now than there was before the closure of Porirua Hospital. So,
wow.
So I think there's a bit of bed, there's quite a few longer-term beds being added by stealth. So, but anyway, getting back to the intention, I think the New Zealand government and both parties were behind this, did well in divesting us of those terrible old institutions. I mean, they were just ghastly. And
well, you worked as a psychiatric survivor, didn't you? Here at
Carrington Hospital, and it was an awful place. I can tell you, it was dreadful.
Yeah.
And then after the Mason report of 20 years ago, there was a real push for new funding to go into community support services. And about 25% of that mental health funding goes into those services in New Zealand. You go across to Australia, the state that has most community mental health support services is Victoria, and that's sitting at 10%. So in some ways we're doing quite well. The trouble is everything stopped. All the progress just sort of stopped about 10 years ago, and nothing really much has happened to advance that journey towards big community in the last 10 years.
Do you think that there's a complacency that, you know, we're still doing very well?
Oh, I don't think there's any sense of complacency about that. I don't pick that up at all. No. I don't know if you do, but I think people are very worried about the state of sort of the way we as a society and the services respond to people who are experiencing distress.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you were talking about the old Porirua Hospital and the growth of beds there. I was thinking that, you know, there is quite a number of acute psychiatric units. I mean, there was a new one that replaced Taharoto on the North Shore.
We've got a
couple on the Auckland City Hospital site. And I was wondering whether anybody actually knows how many acute psychiatric beds there are available throughout New Zealand.
Well, I think, you know, there was a guideline once that there were 15 per 100,000 population. I don't think they've gone over that for acute psychiatric beds. I don't know. But what really... I mean, it kind of breaks my heart to see these, you know, there's a big acute mental health unit being built in Counties Manukau, 75 beds.
Te Aho Mai, the replacement for Te Aho
Mai. I mean, I've been quite publicly critical about this because... you know, there's a great opportunity for people to try other models. And another really good model is, for instance, peer-led services with some clinical input that run in houses and communities.
We
have a few of those around in New Zealand, and I tell you, they work brilliantly. And we keep building these large buildings where people are warehoused, and we keep trying to create models of care that will be better for them, and we keep failing. And I think putting distressed people into big places with a whole lot of other people where, you know, there's a sort of a lock-up kind of system where the nurses are away doing paperwork all day, and you've got some people high on P, you've got other people who are severely depressed, you've got all sorts of distress swirling around in there, and you've got seclusion and forced medication and people feeling trapped. I think that's a recipe for disaster, and those places, to me, are probably one of the unsafest places you could put someone who is at their most vulnerable point in life. And I think why we keep doing it, I mean, I think we need to ask ourselves, why do we keep doing something that is manifestly failing people?
Well, I suppose those people are in crisis, and you know, acute psychiatric units, whether we can say they've worked in the past, I'm not sure. Probably the history would say that they didn't work. The ones that we've got today are probably a little more professional,
actually, the ones we've got today, you know, when I was using mental health services, you know, quite a long time ago now, most of the acute units weren't locked up. A lower percentage of people were on the Mental Health Act, and they were actually probably safer places for the staff and for the, more importantly, in a way, for the people who were staying there than the ones are today. So I think we've gone way backwards.
Right.
In our institutional responses for people in crisis. And ultimately, I think institutional responses don't work.
So your well-being manifesto is to try and turn the ship around, isn't it? And create a completely new model. I'm not sure whether you've got the questions that I prepared there, but... you know, basically your well-being manifesto is recommending that we start from scratch with a completely new model. Am I understanding it correctly?
Well, you know, nothing's ever a blank slate. But what I'm suggesting is that we totally reorganise things at the planning and funding level.
Right.
So that we have pulled... funding from different sectors that have a role in responding to people with mental distress, and that they work at a local or regional level to ensure that the kind of full range of services are available to people. Yeah. And the types of things that I talked about were talking therapies, you know, support and employment and education, housing, whānau and parenting support, self-management, cultural support, connecting back to your community and physical health care and you know, psychiatric treatments for some people. So that's what... what we're arguing in the Wellbeing Manifesto is the DHB alone can't do that. We need a multi-sector approach to it, and they need to be given some instructions from the government to say, you need to make sure that people with mental distress in your community have access to this broad range of support services and opportunities.
Yeah, so you in the manifesto, you talk about 7 wellbeing priorities, and you may have touched on some of those in that list. Are you able to walk us through those 7 wellbeing priorities?
Yeah, so the first one is that, so although the manifesto does focus on the service end of things a bit, we actually believe that for too long, you know, people in the mental health system have been separated from the whole of community wellbeing agenda. And so we want to join those up so that it's less stigmatising for people. And they also have access to those things that help wellbeing. So the wellbeing priorities, the first one is that we live in social conditions that enable us to look after our own and each other's wellbeing. And that's a huge whole of government responsibility. And I think the Treasury at the moment are doing some wellbeing measures, a bit on the same line as, you know, those economic GDP measures. And that would be a really good way for government to start to build in wellbeing into their program. And then secondly, that they know how to recognise and respond to stress, distress and addiction. That people can easily find services and supports for people who are experiencing distress or addiction, that we will get timely, respectful and helpful responses from those services and supports, that we have access to a comprehensive range of community-based services and supports and opportunities, and that we also are supported by people who have walked in our shoes, as well as the traditional mental health workforce. And that includes peer support workers and cultural workers. And we're enabled to reconnect with ourselves, our whānau, and our valued roles in the community. So that's the wellbeing, the 7 wellbeing priorities.
Right, thank you for those, Mary. Could we take a music break? I know we're talking to you at Wellington, but if you wouldn't mind just holding on the line, and I'll just raise particularly one of those, number 6, with you when we come back.
Great, okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Today I've got a song called Years and Years is the actual artist. The song's called Shine, and it's all about light and spirituality and looking for relationships. So you're listening to 104.6 Planet FM, and this is Take It From Us Mental Health Radio.
To go, don't you feel that hunger? I've got so many secrets to show. When I saw you on that stage, I shivered with the look you gave. Don't you hear that rhythm? Can you show me how we can escape?
Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
Yeah, and I'm host Sheldon Brown with Declan Curran, and we're talking today to Mary O'Hagan, who has been one of the main architects of a well-being manifesto, which has been submitted to the inquiry into mental health and addictions, which is being orchestrated by the government. One of the points, Mary, and thank you for holding on there, you say one of the priorities is for people to be supported by those who have walked in our shoes, and of course that's a major focus now of yours, peer support. You're the director of Peer Zone, but in your report you say that there's, of the total workforce, only 2.7% are peer support workers.
It's probably less because they include advisory roles in that too.
So, I mean, this was the big growth area in mental health about five or six years ago. What's happened to the momentum of that?
The rising to the challenge, which was the ministry's, you know, policy document that came out in 2012, had, you know, featured peer support quite prominently. But the trouble was we weren't in a... mental health has been in a holding pattern. It hasn't been in a growth pattern. So there was no opportunity to kind of apply that policy because there was no new money. There was no leadership. Very little innovation going on, and so you can't just have a policy without creating avenues for it to be implemented.
Right.
And I'm afraid, quite often people make policy in Wellington and they don't think about, well, how are we going to make sure this is implemented?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've had a wonderful example just last week where a peer support worker brought his client into the studio. This person had been admitted to a acute psychiatric unit only about 2 months earlier. He's a kickboxer. He's a wonderful guitarist and musician, played live in the studio. And it just seemed to me to be a win-win situation for everybody. And I'm sure the client went away feeling quite chuffed that he'd gained the confidence to play live music in a radio studio, playing live. So,
this is the other change that's slightly more subtle than just, you know, who does the funding. But what we do is we tend to bring people into services if they can get in at all. That's another issue, is a lot of people can't get into them. And then we kind of look after them and sort of pat them on the head and sort of say, you know, and keep them stuck, keep them trapped in services. And what I'd really like to see happen is that we create opportunities for people as part of that resource we have to provide services, supports and so on, that we're also providing opportunities for people. Now, obviously, supported employment and supported education is a way of providing opportunities, but not just sort of going around and seeing them once a week and checking that they're taking their medication and they're not annoying the neighbours and having a chat or taking them to the supermarket. I think we need to get much more ambitious about for people and say, you know, how can we provide opportunities for people to connect back into their communities, to be volunteers in the community, to go to sort of develop hobbies, go on walking groups or whatever it is they like doing, play guitar with people, and I think in a way our community mental health service delivery does it. It's got an invisible wall around it, a bit like the visible wall in the community. And it's not that people are trying to do this. I think we just haven't set it up very well so that, you know, our focus is on, we want people to not need us. We want people to have opportunities. We don't want people sitting here year after year, decade after decade, receiving our services.
Well, probably the weakness in the community mental health system is that people are only introduced to other people with lived experience, not to people who may have had lived experience or have never experienced it.
Exactly. And I think there's a real place for, having an opportunity to be with your peers. But if we just give people that opportunity and don't find ways of, opportunities for people to connect back into the wider world, I think we're ultimately failing them.
Right. This whole focus on well-being, I mean, it's certainly recognised. It's getting quite a bit of profile. One of my points would be that isn't it each of our own personal responsibilities to be well, to make a commitment to be well, rather than to have the state sort of guide us?
Yes, it is. But in order to take responsibility for our own lives, we need hope. We need motivation, and so it's a bit of a tall order. When someone's completely lost hope, or they have such low self-esteem that they can't even see themselves being an active agent in their lives. So I think that's true. And part of the whole recovery approach that we went on about, 20 or so years ago, was actually encouraging people to be active agents in their own lives and to lead their own recovery. And so I think that, services and supports and opportunities provided by the state should be enabling this to happen with people rather than shutting down their capacity for self-agency, which so often they have done traditionally.
Yeah, well, I've been a facilitator for the Wellness Recovery Action Plan, which was born in America, and I think my exposure to that has been very helpful for my own mental and physical health, and learning that it is my personal responsibility to get well and stay well.
That's ultimately freeing for people because when I first went into the mental health system, I thought there were some very clever, nice people there who were going to fix me.
Yes.
And it never happened. And so I had to learn in quite a slow and painful way that I had to take responsibility for my own well-being. The services I had, they didn't encourage that message. They had the sort of grandiose idea that they needed to fix me or keep me in my disability. And so I think there's a bit of a collusion going on there. I think the services haven't helped by giving people low expectations and by sort of being the heroic ones who have to do the fixing.
Right.
Because in the end, we do have to fix ourselves. But then on the other hand, I came from a privileged background. I was white, I was middle class, I had reasonably good self-esteem, and I believed I had a right to have a place in the world. Now, if you don't have that background, it's much harder to ask people to take responsibility. It's a much longer process, I think. Mm. So one thing I don't want to happen is that we start pointing the finger at people who have trouble with this, because some of us start a few rungs up the ladder than other people in terms of being able to take that self-agency on.
Right.
I was just going to say, it's Declan here, by the way, Mary.
Hi.
Hiya. I was just going to say, I make up my medications once a week, and that way you're only focusing on doing that. That sorts that management out if you're self-managing. And, of course, people can get those blister packs as well.
Yeah.
But I find one of the things, firstly, is I don't mention that whole this is who I am and defining a mental illness. But as far as, you know, you're saying getting people back into the community, I found that once you became recluse, you just wanted to stay there because it was that sort of comfort blanket.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to mention there's a group that I found, or a website. It's called Meetup, as in meeting people. And I've joined a group from there and just slotted in, and it's just opened things up and made me want to get out and do more things.
Yeah, so how did you find Meetup? Did the services help you find it, or did you just come across it yourself?
Yeah, no, I just decided I needed to get out and sort of spread my wings. Yeah. And so I just did a hunt online, and Meetup came up, and as good as gold. I had my first meeting a couple of Sundays ago. And about five people, other people in the cafe, and it was great. It does wonders for your self-esteem as well.
Oh, it's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah, no, absolutely. It's really good. I mean, it's great that that people can take up these opportunities. And I think the whole idea of this, I think a lot of people with mental distress who are receiving services and not receiving services lead pretty isolated lives, and that just helps to compound the feeling of hopelessness and low motivation. And
I was just going to say fear of the unknown.
Self-esteem, it really does. Yes.
I mean, isn't that where the support workers can be so helpful in getting up to speed with what sort of supports there are out there, like Meetup, where it's not exclusively a mental health initiative. Well, in fact, it's not a mental health initiative, it's just an initiative to get people together and follow.
And I don't think I think there's a lot of really good support workers out there, so I don't want to diss the support workforce, but I think there needs to be a much more focus on broader community connection among some of them.
Actually, that Meetup site's very good because when you go on, it'll give you a whole list of different interests. It could be TED Talks, things like that, and you just go down and select what sort of area you're interested in, and then it will give you a whole list of groups, tell you a bit about the group, and you just go along and register your interests. I have found it's really opened doors for me. It's pushed me out.
That's really good. It's a great story, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And we want to see more of these opportunities for people who are feeling isolated and marginalised.
So in the manifesto, I mean, and you've touched on this in the interview earlier on, the manifesto, the wellbeing manifesto, has got some clear guidelines about how funding for mental health and addiction should. Would you like to give us a bit of an idea there?
Basically the funding at the moment, most of the funding for mental health services and addiction services goes through the DHBs. But there are other sectors that that provide for people with mental distress and addiction. I mean, there's,
Ministry of Social
Development, health, I mean, education, housing, corrections, ACC, there's a whole lot of them. Now, if you've got all those sectors together at a local or regional level and said, look, just forget everything you're doing for a while. Let's just start with this. The government said we need to provide all these range of supports and resources and opportunities for people. How are we going to do this? How are we going to get together, pull our funding, and make sure that our local community has access to all these things? And this also needs to be done in a sort of community-led development way with the populations who are affected, and that's people with mental distress. And in many communities, it's Māori and Pacifica people who are very high users of services. So we really need to, it's not just about those sectors, it's about the local community, affected community, being part of that decision making.
We've seen a Ministry of Housing being set up with staff from different ministries, executives from different ministries coming in to. Do you think that, as a former mental health commissioner, do you think that there is justification for a Ministry of Mental Health?
Oh, I think there's a justification for a Ministry of Wellbeing.
Right, of course.
We haven't mentioned that. I mean, how the government has said they're going to restart the Mental Health Commission, and we've suggested it be called a Wellbeing Commission.
Oh, right.
And that it takes a broader approach than, the old Mental Health Commission was really just about mental health services and addiction services. But we think a new Wellbeing Commission could have a broader mandate and could oversee the transition from big psychiatry to big community.
Right.
And I just want to say a little bit about how would someone on the ground who's wanting a service experience big community? Well, what we're advocating for is that we have open door kind of pretty one-stop shop community wellbeing hubs that deliver a whole range of comprehensive responses. They could be in primary health, on Marae, community centres, churches, workplaces, probably large workplaces, higher education, schools. And so when you go to a place, or it could be online, but when you go to a place, you can see a peer support worker, you can find someone to help you get a job, you can go and see a GP or a doctor if you want to, you can get help with your housing so that you don't have to be navigating this incredibly fragmented, complex system in order to get the things that you need.
Well, I guess you take a bit of the competitiveness out between NGOs, many of whom are providing employment support.
You have to be referred. See, to get into an NGO, you need a referral. I mean, one of the principles that we're working from is that we shouldn't, if you need help for your mental distress or addiction, you shouldn't have to go through the gatekeeper that's the health system. You should be able to access it.
It's interesting.
Maybe in these community wellbeing hubs.
Yeah, I think it is possible. I mean, certainly this show is funded by Framework, and it is possible to self-refer to many of Framework's programs.
Oh, that's really good to hear.
Yeah.
That's really good to hear. Then you might self-refer to an employment service, but you've got problems with housing. You want to see a peer support worker. You've got physical health needs, or you want to connect back to your culture or your marae or something, and there aren't people there. There aren't people in one place that can assist with that. And I think in an ideal world, I mean, this isn't entirely possible all the time, but in an ideal world, it would be really great to have a place to go to where you can get many of these responses kind of under one roof.
I was just going to quickly chip in there and say I found the very difficult thing for me was to actually get into the system, and it was only when I had a psychotic manic episode and got arrested by police and that sort of thing that they admitted me.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So we need, we've got such a high threshold for people to get help. We've got a primary health system that, doesn't, kind of isn't set up to give sort of a holistic range of responses.
I was just going to say,
And then we've got a specialist system, and you just have to jump so high to get through it that you have to be a danger to yourself or others in order to get in.
I mean, I'm surprised.
That's totally ridiculous.
I'm surprised that you don't mention in this wellbeing manifesto like the current role of the police, because they are the frontline mental health crisis service.
Yeah. Yes, so no, that's interesting you say that. Maybe we could have said something about the police. But basically, if you have an open access to a broad range of resources, I think what you'll find is that the police are involved less.
Yes, yeah.
What I've seen lately is the number of people that are actually ending up in the prison system, and they're not getting the support that they need. So I think police are getting a bit more training now into how to handle situations and realising that, you know.
Maybe there should be a special group of people who deal with these situations that, they might be part of the police or they have some special training. I mean, this wouldn't work in rural areas. But, and another thing I think we need to think very carefully about is, should people with mental distress and addiction be going to EDs and hospitals, or should we provide another place in our communities for people to go to?
Are you saying that they're going to emergency departments now because they can't get into a crisis service?
Well, I think that's the go-to place when there's nowhere else to go, and if we provided other opportunities for people to get support in a non-hospital, non-busy, non-institutional environment, I think that would be far better for people. I imagine if there was a house in the community, it was a crisis. You know, you might call it a crisis house, and that became known as a place you go to if you're feeling really crap, and you can talk to a peer support worker, you can see a nurse or a doctor, or you can see a cultural worker, or you can get looked after in that environment rather than going into one of these horrifically busy, quite sometimes hostile EDs where people are waiting for hours and, their distress just escalates. Mm. And then they don't get a very well-rounded response, when they do get, see someone, because all they get is a psychiatrist or a nurse or someone. And that may be helpful at times for some people, but there's lots of other ways we can respond to people when they're in that state.
I mean, we do have community mental health centres dotted around.
I close at 5 o'clock at night.
I know, yes.
I mean, I'll tell you what, in my experience, when I was going through all my difficulties, most of my crises happened after hours and at the weekends.
Right.
Yeah.
So they were nowhere to be seen.
No.
Exactly. Just wanted to ask to wrap this up. I mean, you talk about an integrated community delivery in this wellbeing manifesto.
Yeah.
I mean, how likely is it that the mental health sector is going to become integrated, because its history demonstrates that it works in silos?
Yeah, well, this is a huge, complex problem. And all the time I've been working in mental health, people are saying we need more collaboration, we need more integration. The only way to do it, I think, is to integrate from the top and from the bottom. So integrated funding and planning, I think, is really important. But also, these different people and different types of services being co-delivered on the ground, instead of, one being over in one suburb and another being over there and they never talk to each other. And I think if we do that, then we might start to solve the problem of integration.
Yeah, I think there has been some promising moves in the Panmure Glen Innes sort of area where there is quite a bit of coordination going on between a number of NGOs.
I think they make really valiant attempts to do it, but I don't think the structures make it easy for them.
Right, right.
So we've got to unblock those structures so that and it's the funding and the planning and the sort of co-delivery idea that I think could unblock some of those barriers.
Yeah. So just in general, the response to your wellbeing manifesto?
Oh, look, it's been pretty positive. I think what we're picking up, and I think what the inquiry panel is picking up, is that there is a bigger mood for change than I've seen in my lifetime. Mm. And it's coming from all areas. Like, I think to some degree it's coming from the DHBs, it's coming from people who with lived experience, from families, from other people. So I think we have a moment where we have a big opportunity. Mm. And the inquiry panel, I have some confidence that they will seize that moment, and I am hoping that the government will respond positively to whatever they recommend.
Yeah.
And I think that the Wellbeing Manifesto is really, it's a reflection of the way the thinking is going. There are people talking along these lines in the UK about how we need to reorganise things so that we don't have a health-centred system, but we have a multi-sector kind of centred system. Mm. Yep. And so I feel some hope that things are going to change. I've been feeling pretty demoralised, quite honestly, for some time about the lack of progress, but with the inquiry and the new government, I think we have a real opportunity.
Oh, that's a very positive place to leave the interview, Mary.
Can I just tell you that if people want to read the manifesto or sign up to the submission on the Action Station website, you can go to wellbeingmanifesto.nz and you'll find you'll be able to read it there and link through to the place where people can sign up.
Excellent. Thanks for letting us know on that. It's a great document, and I think it's got a huge number of positives for a better mental health system.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, Mary, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye. Right, well, let's take another music break. We're getting close to the end of our Take It From Us show today.
I'll give you a couple of minutes at the end. I'm so generous. I try to mix the music up, as you know. So I'm going to go back to for people in our era, back to the 80s with a song, a vocal duet from Barbara Streisand and Barry Gibb. It was actually written by all three Bee Gees, and it was released in 1980, of course. And there's a version by Tom Jones and Gladys Knight. The song's called Guilty, and here is Barbara Streisand and Barry Gibb with Guilty. You're listening to Planet FM 104.6, where mental health radio take it from us.
Street, anybody of me got a heartache, don't let roll. praising God. How grand we are. Little by little we meet in the middle, a danger in the dark. With the love you're building up, you gotta be mine. We take it away. It's gotta be mine. They just come out of the time. And we got nothing to make it here. Our love will climb any mountain we go for. We are. And we never. And we got nothing to be sorry for. Our love is one in a million.
Eyes can't see that we
got a highway to the sky.
I don't wanna hear your goodbye. Don't wanna hear your goodbye.
Take it from us, Community Notice Board.
Now, Waitemata District Health Board and Auckland District Health Board are running a series of workshops. These have already started, but there's still an opportunity. These workshops are to provide better pathways and better services for infants, children and youth who need help for their mental health and general well-being across Auckland and Waitemata districts. They started in New Lynn on the 7th of June. We're just bringing you news about the last three. They will be at the Kelston Community Centre on the 18th of June between 4 and 5.30. On the 19th of June at the Orewa Community Centre between 12 and 1.30. And Windsor Park, which is East Coast Road on the 20th of June between 12 and 1.30. Now, you can email Kim Maru, that's M-A-R-I-U, at waitemata.dhb.government.nz if you want details about addresses for those particular community centres and Windsor Park. So that's been taken from us. I think the National Zero Suicide Forum is on the 19th of June. The investment there is $350 plus just. So that's at the Naomi Auckland Airport Hotel between 9 and 4.30. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Tuesday on Planet FM at 12.30.
See you then. Have a warm week.